Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted that Bremont will be sponsoring the Money Maze podcast throughout this year. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch, brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont. We're also delighted to announce that Schroders, the global investment and wealth management business, will be welcomed as a co-sponsor from next month. Today we're going to talk about one of the most important companies you probably haven't heard of, but about a topic that is central to everyone: pensions. And my guest today is a rock star at the changing landscape of the insurance and pension worlds and running an increasingly critical part of UK financial services. There's nothing new about pensions. Soldiers who served in the Roman armies were guaranteed an income after they retired. The first corporate pension in the US was established by the American Express Company in 1875. And here in the UK in 1908, the Old Age Pension Act introduced a pension of between 10 and 25 pence per week to people over 70. But the importance of the pension promise, whether in the Roman army or British Steel, has lost none of its significance to help you avoid poverty when you no longer work. So whilst when my parents first talked about pensions to me, it had me wanting to run for the hills, please stay with this podcast. And if you're a CEO, a CFO, or a pension trustee, listen up, especially. Your world is changing. So now to our guest, Tracy Blackwell, CEO of the Pension Insurance Corporation, with £50 billion of assets and growing rapidly, and involved in almost a third of the pension buy-ins and buy-outs. We do appear to be at the foothills of immense change. So Tracy, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's step back to the 1970s. I think you were brought up in the Midwest of America. Is that where it all starts?
I was indeed, outside of Chicago.
Right. And you funded yourself through university and also worked in a magic shop. Is that right?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I did all sorts of things. You know, my mother was a single mother, had me when she was very young and didn't have much money, really. So I had to put myself through university and did lots of different things to do that. Worked in an ice cream shop and in university, yes, worked in a magic shop. So ran the costume department of a magic shop where I went to university. And I was also at a time a magician's assistant, which is really good fun. But I know all the secrets and can't tell any of them.
Right. And some would say that equips one beautifully for the investment business. But
oh, I think so, yeah.
But you then moved to Malaysia in 89. So just talk me through that.
So yeah, when I graduated from university, it was in the teeth of a recession, the 1989-90 recession. And I wanted to go into the finance industry. There were no jobs of any kind, which I'm sure a lot of people today will recognize given everything that's happened in the last year. But went to Malaysia doing something called ISEC, which is an international business program, which is in many, many countries around the world where you go and do internships, traineeships in different places all over the world. So I did that for 2 years, then moved to do an MBA in Holland, and then moved to the city of London to work for Goldman Sachs.
Okay, so if I just pause on that post-MBA. If I understand it correctly, the chairman of Philips came to talk to your class and offered you a job, but you told him that's not what you wanted to do. Is that right?
No, slightly different, actually. So he approached me to come in and speak to his female employees. When I finished my MBA, I finished top of the class and was doing a speech for the commencement ceremony and did a speech on gender issues and women in work and how we needed to work together and network and look after each other. And he was so impressed by what I said, he wanted me to come and speak to his female employees. And at the same time, he said to me, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I'd like to work in London, in the city, in financial services. And he very kindly set up three interviews for me. One was with Goldman, which was great. Another was with the vice chairman of what was then Kleinwort Benson, which was an absolutely terrifying experience. You know, me, 24 years old, going into wood paneled dining room, interview room with the vice chairman. And the other was with Lazard in Paris. And so I was just incredibly grateful for somebody picking me out and giving me that opportunity, but just went from there.
So you work at Goldman's, and I think you work at Goldman's for, is it 7 or 8 years, and you rise to be head of risk. Now, Goldman's not an easy place to thrive and survive. Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Oh, it was an amazing journey. So, you know, when I joined Goldman, it was in 1992. You know, Goldman was a family, and I think it very much still had the ethos that if you look after your clients for 120 years, your clients will look after you. And they were very long-term in their thinking. And then that changed. I joined in the fixed income derivatives department at the very, very, very beginning of derivatives, at the beginning of swaps. I mean, 2 years before is when the first IBRD swap had been done. And so it was really at the foothills of the whole derivatives market. Now it's, you know, trillions and trillions, but it was very much more rudimentary back in the beginning. I did that for a long time and then moved over to work in our asset management division, being head of risk management for the asset management division. Very interesting, but different, and a different ethos. And I think in an organization like that, there is a huge difference between the buy side and the sell side and how they look at the world. But eventually, I think what I found was that the ethos of a big investment bank probably didn't suit my values and the way I looked at the world. So I thought it was time to move on.
Right. So you moved to PIC, Pension Insurance Corporation. And I have to admit that as I was doing my work, much of this was new to me. And I found this subset of finance quite complicated, but hopefully you're going to inform, enlighten, and correct me and help our audience understand, you know, these really big shifts that are underway. But let's start with some facts and definitions on pensions, specifically the defined benefit pension market. A defined benefit pension used to be called a final salary pension. It's a type of workplace pension that pays you retirement income based on your salary and the number of years you've worked for the employer rather than the amount of money you've contributed. And let's get, I guess, to the heart of you. If you were Sainsbury's or Rolls-Royce, you ran the retailer or the aero engine company and simultaneously provided a pension pot for your employees, historically in the form of a defined benefit pension. What changed and why?
What changed was the Pension Act 2004. It is amazing to me how legislation can change things so dramatically, but it did. And at the time, I don't think many people really understand the implications of what was happening. But what happened certainly in the UK was that changed the promise to pay for employers from a best endeavors. We'll make every effort we can to pay your pension, but if we can't, we can't do anything about that. Two, it became a hard liability on a company's balance sheet. And as soon as that happened, everything changed because companies that did have big pension schemes suddenly found themselves in a position where it might have an enormous deficit and that now they had to make that good over time. So it really did change, not just the legislation around it and the promise to pay, but also set up the pensions regulator, which is the regulator that oversees defined benefit pension schemes. And the whole regime just became harder, stricter, with a lot more expectations in terms of how it's managed and how it's looked after. And from that moment on, really, it became pretty untenable for most companies to have a defined benefit pension scheme. So you've ended up in a place today, what, 16 years later, where 90% of schemes in the UK are closed to new members and to future accruals. So it's just a big liability sitting on a company's balance sheet that they need to eventually do something about.
And the question I didn't ask you, but I will ask you now, which is, what lured you into the Pension Insurance Corporation?
Well, I was in at the beginning. An ex-colleague from Goldman, one of my very good friends, Danny Truhl, who used to be the chief investment officer of the Wellcome Trust, came to me and said, look, we're looking at starting this up and we'd like you to come and join us, start it. And at the time, I didn't know anything about defined benefit pension schemes, not to the extent that needed to be done. I certainly didn't know that much about running an insurance company or, in fact, how to set up an insurance company, which is what we needed to do. But the outlook was just so compelling and so attractive. To me, it was a no-brainer. You know, there are about 6,000 defined benefit pension schemes, private sector schemes in the UK, with a total liability value of about £2 trillion. So it is absolutely vast and enormous. And there is no question now, with so many of them closed to new members and closed to future accruals, that they're all on the path to de-risk and to move towards insurance company buyouts. And so it's just the overall sector. It was so compelling. And when you read something like that and look at it and see just the vast potential, you can't quite believe it. And even when we started out, I didn't actually believe, I think, that we'd get to where we are. But here we are.
So this is a £2 trillion market. And am I right in saying that so far only about 10% or 200 billion has been transferred to the private sector?
Yeah, that's right. Yep. We're just at the foothills.
And you are having a meaningful share, maybe a quarter of that business currently is being insured by the Pension Insurance Corporation.
We tend to have a market share of between a quarter to a third. In insurance, if you win too much, you're doing something wrong in your pricing. If you win too little, you're doing something wrong in your pricing. So for us, that's kind of about the right place to be.
I suppose the high-level question is that should CEOs and CFOs be running pensions alongside their core business?
Well, it doesn't seem to have made much sense, has it? If you look at the UK, the largest pension schemes are for companies that were enormous 40 or 50 years ago. So anything with British in the name, that tended to be the big conglomerates, the big, big companies. And we see how things have changed. Those are now much smaller. They've sold off different bits. Different things have happened. Those businesses have changed, as they will do. But the pension scheme is there, is still there. I think when these were set up back in the 40s and 50s, nobody realized quite the duration of them, what they would turn out to be in terms of the life of the company. And they've long outlived a lot of those companies.
And so scheme deficits, I read, are close to a record high and they're therefore reliant on corporate solvency. Is this driving or accelerating the rethink?
Well, a few different things have happened. So there's two types of business that we do. One is a buyout, where we take on all the assets and all the liabilities of a pension scheme. And then we have a policy with each of those individual members of the scheme. So they become our policyholders. But what is far more prevalent is buy-ins, where the trustees of the scheme will take a portion of the assets and a portion of the liabilities and give us that for an insurance contract. What they're doing is progressively de-risking the scheme over time, kind of like salami slicing it. So they'll do a bit this year, they'll do a bit next year, they'll do a bit the year after, because in pension schemes, time is your friend, because as markets perform, as they have been, it just chips away at the deficit a little bit over time. So they'll do a little bit here, a little bit there. And that's the, you know, say 80% of our business overall.
If I was to ask you to therefore summarize the purpose and ambition of the Pension Insurance Corporation, how would you define that?
Well, in terms of our purpose, there's no question. Our purpose is to pay the pensions of our current and future policyholders. That's what it's all about. That's why we're there. We are there to ensure that all of these people, these members, get paid their pension over time. That's what it's all about. In terms of our ambition, kind of keeps changing, I think. You know, as I said, when we first started, very long time ago, 15 years ago, never dreamed we'd get to a £50 billion balance sheet. But here we are. So as we said, there's only 10% of the market written into insurance so far. And the sky is pretty much the limit, I think. So we're growing along with the market.
What comes next? The insurers clearly can play in this market. I think I'm right in saying the banks can't, but it may be worth you just summarizing why that is the case. So this gets dominated, what, by a handful of insurance companies?
It's dominated by insurance companies because it is an insurance product. The only way a company can sever its liability to the pension scheme is to do an insurance buyout. So that's the only thing that's acceptable, unless, of course, the company, the underlying sponsoring employer, goes into bankruptcy, where it goes into the pension protection fund. It's a different thing, but those are the only two ways out, really. And so it must be an insurance company. It must be an insurance contract, which is why banks aren't in it. It also is extremely long term. We have some of the longest term liabilities that there are, and we have a very long term asset portfolio to match, which isn't really in when a bank doesn't think as long term, perhaps, as we do. So it doesn't really sit very well in a bank environment.
We're going to talk about the asset versus liability match or mismatch in a minute. Must have read it in your materials that defined benefit schemes only exist in four countries: Holland, Japan, the US, and the UK. And all the European systems are unfunded. And I suppose I've got two questions. First of all, is that right? And secondly, would it be fair to say that one maybe fact in Brexit is the UK won't be embroiled in that question of underfunded pensions in Europe?
Let's go to the first part, which is that the largest defined benefit, final salary / schemes, funded schemes in the world are the UK, Japan, Holland, and the US, and Canada to a different extent. Those are slightly different types of schemes, or they're organized differently. I would be remiss if I said no other European countries have funded pension systems to the same extent, but the vast majority of them don't. It is a very different sort of thing.
So is the UK sort of the petri dish here in terms of having to respond to this new world order?
I think it might be, although other countries have different systems where they do consolidate pension schemes. So Holland, for example, is interesting. So they have what they call industry-wide schemes, which are where a number of employers in a certain industry band together and put all their pension funds together and they manage them as one. Canada has a completely different system. They have very large, they're more public sector schemes, which you could have in the UK as well. Interesting thing about the UK is the public sector schemes are still very disparate and they are standalone and separate instead of having one large scheme like, say, the Canadians do. But the defined benefit, the private sector schemes are very much coming together under the banner of insurance companies. So it is happening in a number of different places. Because the costs of running a defined benefit pension scheme are high, you need to have different sets of lawyers, investment consultants, custodians, people who do the operations, everything. And bringing those all together does give some economies of scale. So different countries have found different ways of doing that, and they've constructed it slightly differently. But I think it is a trend we're seeing in a number of different places. But in terms of private sector schemes, the UK is definitely, I would say, ahead of the game in terms of that.
And the UK private sector is £2 trillion. Is it the same size in the public as well? And will that follow the same path ultimately, or is that more nuanced?
It is £2 trillion in the public sector as well, roundabout, and it should follow the same path. I'm not convinced it will. If you think about it, those public sector schemes are, in fact, taxpayers' money. So the taxpayer, the government, should be mandating how that works. Right now, they are all still run as very separate schemes, and the costs associated with all of that are high. You've seen some consolidation investment management in some of the schemes, but there's clearly a long way to go in that. It also could be really powerful for the country in terms of thinking about where we can invest those funds in the future. But I think there's quite a lot of resistance to that.
So maybe let's, for the sake of illustration, use a case study. I read that you have clients, because it's on your website, Total, Honda, Citi, BHS, British Steel, Philips. Maybe just give me a case study of how it works from the beginning of the conversation through to execution.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think possibly one of the best case studies to use is Philips Electronics, which we did the buyout of the remaining bit of the scheme a few years ago. But we'd been talking to Philips, and they've been talking to the industry for probably around about 10 years or so, trying to think about how they could de-risk their scheme over time. And we see this a lot where schemes are on the beginning of a journey, a de-risking journey, and over time, they just slowly get there. They don't get there all in one leap, but they get there slowly over time and progressively de-risk a scheme. So for them, what they did was they started doing a series of buy-ins where they would take, as I said, part of the liabilities, usually the pensioners, and part of the assets, again, usually cash or gilts, and they would exchange those for a buy-in policy, which would cover then, they wouldn't have any of the investment risk, they wouldn't have any of the longevity risk, they wouldn't have any of the expense risk around that bit of their population. And then the next year, they do a bit more and they do a bit more till they got to the end. And by the time they got to the end, actually, they were in the process of doing a demerger. But when a corporate event like that happens, the company has to deal with its pension scheme. It's part of the package. It's part of what they need to do. And sometimes that's quite complicated. In fact, it's very complicated in a number of ways. But the trustees of the pension scheme, along with the company, got to a place where they said, right, we think we are now in a place to buy out the rest of the scheme. So we can tie all of that up, make sure that those members are secure in their pensions. And then that leaves us free to go about the corporate reorganization that we want to do. So we worked with them all the way along the way. When you get to the end and the trustees are ready to do a transaction, it generally is an auction process. They will go to an employee benefit consultant who will run the process for them. They'll get a number of different bids. It usually goes through a few rounds of pricing. And eventually they get to a place where they get to not just the price they like, but also, and one of the things that stands out for us is the service that we give to our members, to our policyholders. And they very much look at how we're going to look after those members over time. And then we get to a place and it's a fairly complicated transaction, but then we take over all the assets and the liabilities of the scheme. And then we issue an insurance policy to each of those members and they become our customers. So it's one of those funny things where the customer we sell to is the trustee, but actually the customer we will have for the next 50 or 60 years is actually the end member.
Right. So let's talk about the asset allocation, because you are taking on these long duration, I guess 40 years in some cases, plus liabilities exposed to inflation. The UK defined benefit industry's long-standing love affair with index-linked government securities is well documented. I think that they're probably running, if I understand it correctly, at about 20% of a typical allocation, and you're locking into negative yields right now. That traditionally they were seen as safe havens, but you've written yourself in an environment of negative yields and record deficits, they are anything but. So I guess help us understand that.
Well, first things first, when we take on a new scheme, we have to hedge the interest rate and inflation risk of that transaction that we take on. There's kind of no choice in the matter. The long duration nature of these schemes means that small changes in interest rates or inflation actually have a very big impact on the value. So on day one, we hedge out the interest rate and inflation risk. There's no choice in it. And as you say, you prefer not to be locking in at negative real yields where they are, but that's just the nature of where you are. But then we have eliminated that risk going forward. So then we have a portfolio where we invest, as you say, for the very long term. It's not only just 40 years, there's a whole series of cash flows up to that. But yes, we are looking for very, very long-term investments. So our asset allocation, and when I say investments, I mean credit. From an insurance company perspective, you pretty much need to hold and invest in corporate credit of some shape or form. And that's what we tend to do, certainly for the bulk of the book.
I think one could argue that governments are not going to be in a hurry to revert to a more normal interest rate structure, particularly with the levels of debt and their likely path to try to inflate this debt away. And on your website is a piece that I would encourage anybody to look at called The Purpose of Finance. And I'm going to quote it, where it says, increasing the share of risk-seeking assets in the portfolio is particularly advantageous both to poorly funded schemes and to those that have a weak corporate sponsor. So you have to buy your index link component, but tell me a little bit about what else in that asset pool can you own and how you're thinking about it.
Yep. So we need very long-term investments. We need very long-term fixed income investments. And if they're inflation-linked, the better. We started out with a very small portfolio in UK corporate credit. We expanded. We realized very quickly that you weren't going to get enough diversification in that. We needed to move elsewhere. So we started to invest in US corporate credit. We then moved into emerging market investment grade credit. We have a number of other assets with fixed income characteristics that suit the portfolio. But then a few years ago, we realized that the only way to really fulfill what we needed to do in terms of cash flow, in terms of putting money to work, was to start looking at direct investments. We started a few years ago now where we do our own direct investment in things like infrastructure, for example, social housing here in the UK, university funding, university accommodation funding. Because it's a voracious animal. We just need to put more and more money to work. We've started to build our own assets, manufacture our own assets. For example, we've started building private rental sector accommodation rentals. in the UK. It hasn't been that way in the UK, really, but there is an ever-expanding and growing market for that. So we are starting to manufacture our own buildings, building private rental sector accommodation in places like Manchester City Centre, which is very much working to help regenerate that as well. And we're doing that in a number of different places, working with local authorities to help regenerate various places around the UK. And so there's a lot of different things that we will develop over time, which will help fulfill that. It is what we're looking for is long-term secured assets.
Having recently interviewed both the CIOs of Cambridge and Oxford, we've talked about inflation risk and the place of equities in that. Now, you've got to abide by Solvency II regulations. Is there any give? Is there any in your discussions with the government? Is there going to be any change in terms of the assets that would be deemed appropriate?
I don't think so in a big way. So Solvency II, and forgive me for being this boring, but Solvency II is a very prescriptive set of European regulations that govern how we manage insurance companies. And some of the things in there just don't really suit the UK, really don't suit many insurance companies, but certainly in terms of the prescriptiveness of what you can invest in. But I don't think it's going to be a wholesale. You can invest in anything you want. It's still an insurance company. We still have our policyholders' pensions to look after. So it does need to be safe and secure over the long term.
Okay, but if you were sitting there at the other side of the table in the Treasury knowing what you do, would you actually say, well, you know what, forestry has proved to be a pretty secure and sustainable series of cash flows over long times, i.e. what would you push to change?
What I would push to change is just some of the things at the margins. So things like, no, I don't think it is appropriate for insurance companies to invest certainly in the assets that are backing the policyholder liabilities. I don't think it is appropriate to invest in things like forestry or tech companies or whatever it is. Those assets, those investments have to be secure for the long-term payment of those pensions. That's important. There's another set of an insurance company's assets, which is the surplus capital, where you can do stuff like that. You can do it now, actually. The capital charges for doing it might be slightly high, but that would just reflect the risk that you're taking.
So we've got a lot of commentary and a lot of momentum in the whole ESG space. It's clear to me that you're playing an important role in the S part of that equation because you're building out social infrastructure. Do you get cross-examined on the E and G, and how do you think about this new holy trinity?
Absolutely. We definitely get cross-examined on the E bit. Sadly, I think more investors should be talking about the S and the G, but I think the E has kind of hijacked everything, which is a bit unfortunate because if you do the G bit, the governance bit in particular, well, then the S and the E bit should look after themselves slightly, not entirely, but it definitely would be a better outcome. We do get asked quite a lot, and we are doing quite a lot on it, like everybody is. So, for example, in our portfolio right now, we hold more assets in renewable energy than we do in oil and gas. But I think we also need to be a bit careful that we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, real change is going to come from those big oil companies, you know, the Shells, the BPs of this world, who have the money to make some of those changes. And to sell all of those down right now doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do, because they may be the agents of change for the future. So it's kind of a watching brief.
Right. I should mention Mike Munro, who we both know, who was a partner and now is a consultant at CMS, one of the top 10 global law firms that's executed a lot of transactions in this space. And talking to him, he raised the question of how do you think CEOs and trustees should weigh up their options in this world we find ourselves in?
I think it's difficult, but I think there's so much momentum behind it as well that we're really starting to see some really interesting and positive change. I mean, one of the things that came out of a lot of the work that we did on the purpose of finance is the role of asset owners and the fact that if people really want things to happen, the asset owners are the ones to make that change. So asset managers, they don't really have many degrees of freedom. They need to do what they're told to do by their clients, and their clients are the asset owners. And that's pension funds, insurance companies, sovereign wealth funds, etc. They're the ones who are going to drive the change. And I think that really is starting to happen now.
And if I was listening to this as a pensioner, I could say, well, hang on, I understand this, but my pension has gone from the corporation to this company, PIC. Haven't I just swapped one counterparty risk for another?
Well, no, you have definitely swapped a counterparty risk for another, but you've definitely swapped it for a better counterparty risk. So if you are in a corporate pension, there's no capital backing the promises that have been made to you, and you are reliant on the covenant of your employer. For many, many years, what we've seen is that trustees and members overestimate the covenant that they have from that employer. Even the strongest companies might not be there in 10, 20 years' time. And the best example of that is BP and Deepwater Horizon. BP was one of the most solid companies out there, one of the biggest companies in the UK. And suddenly Deepwater Horizon happened. And there was actually, for the first time, a concern over the longevity of BP and whether it was going to be there in 10, 20 years' time. Under an insurance regime, not only do we have to hold an enormous amount of capital to back those promises, we also are covered by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme, which covers all insurance policies, and where if a UK insurer did fail, and a UK insurer has never failed, by the way, that policyholders would be protected 100%.
Tell me a little bit about how you manage the potential growth, which in itself is not without its issues.
Absolutely. It is very different running a small entrepreneurial organization, company that's growing, to managing what is going to be a very large insurance company. It's just kind of chalk and cheese, really. We're learning every day of the things that we need to do and put in place to be able to fulfill all of that and to fulfill the growth.
But with all this growth, how do you take care of the culture? Because I sense from your earlier comments that culture is really important.
Culture is incredibly important to us. It always has been, really, from the beginning of when we started PIC. I think part of that stems from the fact that a number of us were refugees from bigger companies where we didn't necessarily like the culture and what we saw in financial services overall. So we aimed and we set out to build a very specific culture that was very open, transparent, collegial, and there were no politics. We do things like our policyholder days, where we invite our policyholders from different parts of the country to come and meet us. It's fantastic. But importantly about that day is we make all of our employees go help out and participate in one of these, because they remember who their customers are then. They look those people in the eye. And I think that is so important today, not just in business, but especially in financial services, where because of agency problems, your end customer is so far away from you, potentially, in terms of what you are delivering, that you forget who you're actually working for. You think you're working for yourself and the company. You're not. We're working for our policyholders. Culture is the how you do something. Purpose is the why you do something. And you can't have the how before you have the why.
That is very well expressed, Tracy. Thank you. I'm going to ask you a few general and closing questions. You married a Blackwell, and Blackwell's Oxford bookstore, and the business goes back to the 1870s. And we have an arrangement with Blackwell, because my partner, Will Campion, comes from Oxford, that we want people, when they buy books recommended on the bookstore, to use Blackwell's. But my question is actually, you as an American married into a UK establishment family. My gosh, that was a bold decision. Does it get any easier?
No, it doesn't get any easier. You're tall. Are you kidding? I'm learning every day.
Well, well done you. But along your way, I have to ask you, did you run into glass ceilings?
I don't think I really did. You know, I think about this a lot, especially, you know, with everything we've talked about recently with Me Too movements, etc. Did I? No. Did I suffer harassment? Absolutely. You know, no question. I worked on a trading floor with 400 men. You must be joking. Of course. You know, there was that was just kind of endemic. I hate to say it. Did I at the time think it was a problem? A little bit. Did I let it define me? No. What I learned along the way was, especially for women, what is absolutely vital to succeeding in your career is being yourself. And if you try to be somebody else, if you try to be, you know, like a man in the way that men do things, you're not going to succeed, because you're not being true to yourself. You're not actually expressing what you need to express. And so it really is important, I think, for women to succeed, not just in financial services, but pretty much overall, is it is important to be yourself and do what you think is important, do what's true to your values, and everything will follow from that.
Now, you have an important and high-pressure job, and you get bombarded with information. How do you both manage that information overload, and how do you spend your days off?
Information overload is endemic, especially, I think, when you are running a very highly regulated business, because a lot of what you're doing and documenting and bringing to boards, etc., is not just for you, it's also for a regulator. So that's important. I have a good team, obviously, around me. That's absolutely crucial in all of this. I am blessed with the ability to read extremely quickly. So I think that helps. If I read very slowly, I think I'd be in big trouble. But I'm quite good at assimilating information quite quickly. But it's a challenge. And it does make it difficult to really take in the nuances of everything. But that's what you have a team around you for. Days off? Oh, I don't know. I have a 14-year-old son. That makes it slightly trickier, I think, to have any days off. It's been busy. You know, it's been a great ride with PIC. We've had a great time. We've built an amazing business. But hopefully someday in the not too distant future, I will actually have some free time and be able to do different things. I live in the country, lots of gardening, lots of sailing, like to ski, all of that sort of stuff. But it's kind of few and far between. And as we all know this year, none of that's really existed. So hopefully we'll all be back to it soon.
Yes. My final question. I'm told that your favorite film is Gone with the Wind. Why?
During lockdown, I didn't make my son and husband sit down and watch it, but I hadn't watched it for a long time and I thought they'd enjoy it. And they were absolutely appalled. They hated it. So the reason I liked it, especially when I was a young woman, is it's a time when there's a young woman in a really difficult position who has to take charge of her life and succeed, whether she likes it or not. And she's got guts and she's got, you know, old-fashioned word, gumption. And she gets up, dusts herself off and gets on with it. And, you know, that's always been what I think I've done and has been very appealing to me. So it's the spirit, I think, of Scarlett O'Hara that I like more than anything else.
Well, while you've been doing that, I've been making my children watch Where Eagles Dare. So I'm not sure how that sets us up respectively as parents.
Well, I have a 14-year-old son who's made me watch Where Eagles Dare about 14 times already. So I think I could recite it backwards.
Fantastic. Well, what did they say in the film? They said, yes, I thought the cathedral was on the other side of the square. There we go. So, Tracy, I've learned a lot. I think our listeners will also learn a lot from this conversation because it is not familiar to many. I've got two key takeaways is that for UK pension fund trustees, CEOs and boards, there is change happening and it needs to be thought about carefully and to understand the landscape. And I have two daughters. Advice for women, simply be yourself. I think that is really, really valuable. So with that, I'm going to say thank you once again. It's been lovely talking and we'll look forward to meeting in due course.
Delighted. See you soon.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.